Okay. Right, let's get started. We may not use the whole slot this time, but I wanted to at least have a brief attempt at wrapping up and summarising what we've talked about, and I'll put the sample exam paper up and give you a chance to ask any questions that may have come up about that, and then I have a questionnaire for you at the end. So there's not a whole lot I want to say. Do stick a hand up and ask a question at any point, because that's the kind of main purpose of this. Pretty much everything that you need to revise for the exam, or you might want to look back at it future, is here on the schedule page. So what is there to say? You pretty much have to know everything that's on any of the slides. You have to have done the required reading. You have to be able to answer reasonable questions about it. You don't necessarily have to have done the suggested reading. It could happen that I could ask you a question in the exam which will be easier to answer if you have done a particular piece of suggested reading, or indeed if you have happened to have come across any particular other thing, because all the suggested reading improves your general knowledge about software engineering, and the more general knowledge you have about software engineering, the easier it's likely to be to answer a software engineering exam. But I would not ask questions specifically about the suggested reading. That's why it's suggested, not required. What else is there to say? Tutorials. The material in the tutorials is kind of integral to the course, so you should revise the tutorial sheets just as you revise the rest of the material. In particular, if I ask a question on one of the tutorial sheets, I expect you to be able to do it, and I might expect you to be able to do it in exam. Okay? So I think that particularly applies to the cases of developing UML diagrams for particular situations, because mostly there's not very much detail on the slides. The tutorials gave you extra practice in that and a chance to clarify any misunderstandings. So make sure that you've clarified that at some point. In fact, one thing I should point out is that there's a UML revision sheet by request of last year's students here, which you might possibly find useful. The idea is that it's just a kind of aide memoir. It's not to be taken into exams, okay? It's not that kind of aide memoir. It's just something to have a quick look at and check that you haven't forgotten any bits of the notation. It also, by the way, demonstrates there's not really very much notation in the course. The key thing is to understand confidently what it all means and how to use all of it. This is something that people quite often seem to do badly. I'm always shocked by the number of people who go into the INF2C exam, as it was, and I ask them to draw a sequence diagram, and they draw something which simply isn't a sequence diagram. I think, kind of, how can that happen? But, okay. So, but more or less everything you need to know is here. Might not be absolutely all, but at least that should be a decent revision point. So you have your basic notation for class diagrams, generalizations, associations with multiplicities and names, interfaces shown by various different means, the use of interfaces, objects. So I understand there was some confusion about object diagrams. Okay. So an object diagram is simply a diagram which has objects in it and links between objects in the same kind of way that a class diagram would have classes and associations between classes. Okay. So this is how you represent an object. The reason why there isn't a separate diagram of a link between objects is because they look exactly the same as associations. Okay? So if I want to show a copy called C being linked to a particular book called B, I'm just going to have... Can you read that, actually, or is it just too small? Is it okay? Yeah? So we have a C colon copy underlined there. We just have a B colon book underlined over there, and we just put a straight line between them. And that shows one particular object of class copy being linked to one particular object of class book. And that's useful if you want to demonstrate particular situations that can arise in your software design, particularly actually in cases where you have two objects of the same class and you want to show how they're linked or how they interact. What else is there? Use case diagrams are really pretty easy, I think. Just make sure you know it. Strictly speaking, I think the phrases that give the use cases here really ought to be capitalized. I ought to have used a capital C for create and a capital O for observe behavior, because use cases are classifiers, remember? And the names of classifiers get capitalized in UML. But that's the kind of mistake that's often made. I don't think I could envisage penalizing that one. Sequence diagrams often cause a degree of confusion, but I think it's more a confusion about the way the flow of control actually goes than about the notation when people get confused about that. What is there to notice here? So remember that you need these closed black triangle heads for ordinary synchronous communication. It's important you get those right, because there are in UML other kinds of message arrows that we didn't talk about that mean different kinds of communication. When an object gets created partway through an interaction, you get this particular kind of notation. Two ways it's different. It's different because the lifeline, the head of the lifeline, gets written a little further down the page to indicate that the object has just been created. And unusually, the arrow doesn't go into an activation bar. It actually goes into the head itself to indicate that it's being created. This is mostly pretty self-explanatory, I think, if you've followed it. The notation, therefore, giving a name to the return value from an operation. In this case, we're taking, you probably can't read the word, but it's an operation called query, and its return value is being given the name, just for purposes of this sequence diagram, I. Okay. And the reason we're doing that is because later on in this same sequence diagram, we're going to want to use that name. So we then use the I as an argument to a later message. Okay, that's the only reason you would name a return value in a sequence diagram. This down here is not so important. This is just a diagram of a collaboration. So it looks awfully like an object diagram. It has technical differences, like you don't underline the names, and you may expect to see users in them, because you're talking here about something that might be useful for representing one or more interactions by means of sequence diagrams, but don't really worry about that too much. Okay. So looking at the overall structure of the course, we started off by a kind of overview of what software engineering is and an introduction to the course, and that too is examinable. Might well ask about that. The coursework by itself is not examinable, because you all did different things. How could it have been? But I might well assume that you've accumulated the kind of general understanding of software engineering that comes from it. We had a lecture that was about larger systems and why large systems are different from the kind of small programs that you've written in programming courses before. Then we had a sequence of lectures in which we went through the different activities that have to be done at some stage during the software engineering process. And we did it almost in the order that one would expect to come across it in the waterfall process. We started with requirements, we went through to design, we talked about construction. Then I think just because interaction was a short lecture, interaction, which is really part of design, came there after construction, along with VVNT, but that was really for administrative reasons. Deployment and maintenance. Then we had three lectures which were about the software engineering process itself. A general lecture about processes, a specific lecture about agile software development processes, and a lecture here about quality and process improvement and that kind of stuff. And then we had a group of lectures that were about various aspects of non-functional requirements and related issues, usability, also a bit about the user's role, non-functional requirements, security engineering, licensing and IP, and a little bit about ethics with a Therac 25 story. And now we're in the review, which has no slides because I'm just wittering faced with the web. Okay. Any questions about that? Anything unclear? So I thought the next thing I would do would be to actually go through the sample exam paper. Okay, so the reason I've written a sample is not because the content of the course has changed very much. It hasn't. It's just because the style of the exam has changed radically this year. So if you look back at the previous past papers for INF2C, you'll find, of course, they're a mixture of computer systems and software engineering questions, and they have a distinctive style with half multiple choice questions and then some longer questions. So for software engineering this year, I decided to do it differently. There were a number of reasons for that. One of the reasons was that I'd just got really fed up with trying to invent novel multiple choice questions. You wouldn't believe how hard it is to invent new multiple choice questions that aren't just slight rehashes of the old ones. Partly it was because I wanted to get away from a situation in which I was giving people choice about which questions to answer, because I feel that this course is so fundamental that really, you know, you shouldn't have to and you shouldn't need to game the system and revise some parts of it and not others. Okay, what I really want is to say you should be able to answer basic questions about any aspect of software engineering covered in this course. And since it's now just a one-hour exam, I also didn't want you to have to faff around with trying to choose which questions would be the best ones for you. This is the kind of exam you can start at the beginning, go on until you get to the end, and then stop. With the one exception that, as it says here on the instructions to candidates, this will be exactly the same in the real thing. You may find that the questions in the paper vary in difficulty, and if you do find one tricky, just skip it out and go on to the next. Okay? It's not systematically going from easy questions to difficult questions. If there's something you're just unsure about, just skip it and come back to it if you have time at the end. And you probably will have time at the end. I'm not trying to put you under time pressure in this exam. I think the general situation is, if you know your stuff, you'll probably find this really quite easy and quite straightforward. My hope is, if you don't know the stuff, you'll find it impossible. Okay? Because the idea is people who followed the course reasonably and know it should pass easily without too much stress, and people who haven't followed the course and don't know their stuff should not pass the course. Now, whether I've achieved that is another question entirely. But okay. It's not working. Yeah, right. So what do we have? We have 5 questions. Each question is worth 20 marks. Now, one of the things I'd certainly want to point out is that if you look at the previous past papers, the number of points per kind of minute of work is very different this time. Okay, so it used to be the case that a long question was worth, was it 20 or 25 marks? I forget. But you know, for 2 marks, you'd have to write a fair bit previously. But for administrative reasons, it's convenient if the exam as a whole is marked out of 100. So this one is marked out of 100. You've got 100 marks, 60 minutes. Okay. So you can get more than 1 mark per minute if you're doing it perfectly. And what that means is that if you look at a question from an INF2C past paper and it says it's 4 marks, you might well have to write a paragraph for that. Whereas here for 4 marks, you might only have to write a sentence. Okay. But it may well vary from question to question. I don't have to make all the marks equally easy to get in this paper because of the fact that there's no choice. Okay? Because everybody gets to do every question. Doesn't matter if question 5 is much harder than question 2 or vice versa. So that might happen. Okay? It's not that I've deliberately made it happen, but I haven't gone to great lengths to make them comparable in difficulty as I used to. Okay. So the thing that ought to be giving you a clue about how much you're expected to write is the amount of space that's left in the box on the paper. Okay. Now, obviously, this is only a rough guide. With the real paper, not with this one, by the way, so this one may not be such a good guide. With the real paper, I did actually go through and, in my own handwriting, write out kind of perfect answers in the boxes I'd left to make sure that the boxes were a reasonable size. Obviously, if you have larger than average handwriting, you might overflow the boxes. That's absolutely fine. I'll do anything that's reasonable. If I can find your work, I'll find it. Feel free to kind of write me little notes and say on blank page opposite and cross stuff out and what have you. If I can decipher it, I will, but try to make sure I can decipher it, because I can only give you marks for stuff if I can find it and read it. So, question 1 here. Briefly describe the access control mechanism in the context of Java packages, list access modifiers where applicable, and explain their meaning. Okay, nice little warm-up question. Bookwork, you should know. Private protected public package, you should be able to explain them. There was a piece of required reading that is relevant to that, if you doubt that at all. Here's a case where the box here is not so well sized. Okay, if this had been the real one, I'd have gone back and made the box bigger, but I was trying to get this out kind of in a hurry. Okay, so we've got a mixture of questions which are being straight bookwork and questions which are trying to test whether you understand what you can do, and some which are intended to be a little bit more open-ended. So this particular one is asking you to demonstrate that you understand the software engineering significance of those access control modifiers that you just discussed above. Okay. Yes. And do you know what refactoring means? A problem with the old style of exam where I didn't have boxes was that quite a lot of people, and this actually applied to people who were very strong in the subject and also to people who were very weak in the subject, so I don't think it's really a matter of how well people knew the material. Quite a lot of people would waffle. Okay, I got lots of instances of people writing two-thirds of a page for something where really all I wanted was, you know, one sentence and another sentence. Okay, I think one does this under exam conditions out of stress quite often. Try not to. If you do it, you'll run out of space in the boxes and it may cause you some embarrassment. I never mark by amount of stuff written. Okay, I think people sometimes tend to be tempted to think that that's what's happening. But if you look at the mark scheme here, you can see there are particular things to say, okay? And they're worth particular marks. If you say one of them three times, you don't get any more marks than if you just say it once. Having said that, it does also happen that people will answer a question in a way I hadn't expected, and I try very hard to give appropriate marks. If what somebody said is not what I expected, but it's a reasonable reading of the question, I realise that their point is equally valid, or I realise that my question was ambiguous. I will, of course, try hard to give the marks. Okay. Question two was about a particular environment where basically you just have to demonstrate that you remember the existence of the AutoConf tool and what it's for. And you get two marks just for that one word, two marks for writing AutoConf. Okay? So that's what I mean by saying that you get sort of more marks per minute of work in the new style of exam than you would have done in the old Inf 2. Both in this one and in the real one, all the marks are multiples of two. This is because I initially wrote it out of 60 and then the ITO asked me to please make it be out of 100, so I locked a question off the end and doubled all the marks. Okay, I don't know what there is to say about this particularly. If anybody has any questions arising from having looked at the sample paper, now would be a good time to ask. So I think this is reasonably representative of the kind of balance between bookwork and problem solving. Roughly speaking, if you knew all the bookwork perfectly, yet you didn't understand any of it and couldn't apply it at all, I'm sorry to say you would probably pass. But fortunately, that never happens, okay? Because people who really know all the bookwork normally can apply it a bit, but that's the kind of proportions we're normally looking at. Okay, so here's a kind of question which is really easy to write. You can reasonably expect to find something a bit like this, not necessarily UML class diagrams, but some kind of UML. Here's a situation. You're told a particular kind of UML class diagram to write. You're told something about, if necessary, sort of what level of detail you're expected to include. In this case, it's a UML class diagram, and you're being asked to include multiplicities for any associations. Okay. I need to say that because if I didn't, you might reasonably leave them off, because at different stages in development, people might or might not include multiplicities. But in this one, I've asked you to do that. Okay. And so you're just expected to go through and identify the classes, and the classes are identified for you, they're in italics here. You're expected to identify the relationships between them, the multiplicities of the associations, name them appropriately. Okay. And this is just a check that you understand how to use UML, that you're able to draw a UML diagram. In this particular case, there's no particular intelligence required to do it. I'm not asking you to do a design task particularly, I'm just asking you to transfer into UML notation what's already represented in that passage. I could ask you to do something that would involve a little bit of design, but it would be quite straightforward if I did. This is an introductory course. Okay. You have to know what coupling and cohesion are, and you have to know why it matters. I think this was actually blank in the, this is blank in the model answers thing. I'm not expecting anything very sophisticated there. If you give me the one sentence definition of what coupling is, the one sentence definition of cohesion, and you tell me that systems that have low coupling and high cohesion tend to be easier to maintain, fine, you get the marks. Okay. What is JavaDoc two type? Describe the use of two types of JavaDoc comments with an example. I nearly deleted that. I thought that was a mildly mean kind of question. But actually, if you had done the required reading and remembered it, you would be able to answer that question. It's probably a little harder than anything in the real exam. How many people would have been able to answer that question, by the way, offhand? You remember two types of JavaDoc comments and an example? A few, yeah, okay, good. Right. okay, what is a user story? Where does it come from? Give an example. Draw a use case diagram for the system. Okay, another. Draw a UML diagram for this. Make sure you know that it's not just the blob on there. An ethics question. This is one of the few things which is new in the course this year. Okay, so you won't find ethics questions on the Inf2C past papers, but you could easily find an ethics question on the real paper this time. This one's very straightforward. It's first of all checking that you remember what's in the code of ethics. So it includes 8 principles, and you're supposed to list 5 of them. And we're not being totally unreasonable here. We're not expecting you to remember the exact wording, but we are expecting you to remember things like, you know, public. A software engineer shall act in the public interest. Okay, and the wording doesn't have to be exact, but the sentiment does. Can you apply them? Can you briefly describe 2 scenarios in which applying one of these ethical principles would determine for you what you should do? The FERAP 25 part of the lecture might help you there, but it doesn't have to be to do with that. Anything you invent would be fine. And I asked you at the very beginning to think about cases in which the principles conflict, and here's a question that's asking you, do they conflict, you know, to find circumstances under which they conflict. And that's that. Okay. So what I'm going to do now is I've got a questionnaire for you. This is not the standard questionnaire, by the way, and actually I noticed the link on the course page does point at the standard questionnaire, so I should fix it so it points at this one. I've asked some particular things that I particularly would like some feedback on. It won't be me lecturing into CSE next year, I hope, because I'm going to be on sabbatical. But there are some things that I'm a little bit concerned about that I want to be able to pass some information on to next year's lecturer. So I'll come around and hand these out. And in the meantime, if you want to have a chat, and if there are any questions that have come up, then I'll ask you for them when I get back to the bottom. So I know sometimes you don't want to stand up, but if you ask your neighbour and your neighbour is also puzzled, then that might... I'll start at the back. Sure. Very spread out. Can you pass one along? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Should be the right number. See if I can find the clip that I've just read from. Went flying. The clip that was on. Oh no, it's there. Ha, it's all attached to me. That's fine. Good. Who's not got one still? Yeah. Just to come. Yep. Over here? Got one? Okay. Anybody still not got a questionnaire? I should say one word about the coursework. I've got all the marks in from the markers just now. I'm in the process of going through and checking that I believe that the markers marked consistently and fairly, and I'll send them out. Might be this evening, but certainly no later than tomorrow. Okay. So that's for part 2 of the assignment. Okay. So So that's all I have to say. So if you could fill in your questionnaires and then maybe come and leave them on the front desk here, or if you want to take them away and fill them in later, that's also fine. So thank you very much for your attention. And I'll stay around if anybody's got any questions. Yep. Sorry, you had a question?
A question about one of the questions in the sample paper.
Okay, sure.
It was to do with what ISO 9000 and CMMI were and the differences between them. And the lecture notes on it were quite vague, the definitions were hard to grasp. Just wondering if you could.
Yeah. So let me go back to the. Probably the best thing is if I go back to the lecture and I'll show you what I was expecting you to say. So GSwebOC 2004 is also relevant there, but I think there's probably I wasn't expecting anything very sophisticated here, so probably what's here is enough. Yeah, so if you say CMMI is the capability maturity model integration, a quality improvement framework, you get the marks for that. If you say ISO 9000 is a quality control framework, you get the marks for that. Okay. If you explain the difference between a quality improvement framework and a quality control framework by saying something like quality improvement focuses on how you can improve quality incrementally as you go, quality control is about making sure that you consistently do things that you plan to do. That's the kind of level I was expecting. Anything else to say about that? Yeah, here you go. So, yeah. Yeah, I think that's fine. Yeah, by the way, don't let the questions on the questionnaire stop you from writing anything that you want to write. If, you know, I wanted to keep it onto two sides and I focused on the things I particularly wanted answers for, but I'm not attempting to stop anybody saying anything, really, that you think might be relevant. So, you know, feedback is always good and we don't get enough of it, actually. I should say feedback is always useful. It's not always good. That's why it's useful. Thank you very much. That's great. So the point is that if you're writing in Java, you're running in JVM, and that gets you passed.
Yeah, I know, but there'll be a replacement for if you can use something else, though. Is there something?
That's really nice. But the question wasn't, I've locked it off. Shall I log in again? Yeah.
It doesn't matter. It was probably able to channel.
I should say, I mean, this paper hasn't gone through the same kind of careful scrutiny that the real one goes through. I mean, the real one gets read by half a dozen lecturers, and it gets done by my TA, and everybody pores over the reading and says, could this possibly be misinterpreted? And the sample one was just written by my TA and edited by me. So it wouldn't surprise me if there was a word in that wasn't too clear. So, but if there's something that actually throws up something you're confused about, then send me an email. Sir?
Is that sound 1 hour?
Yes.
Seems like quite a lot.
12 minutes per question. I think if you try actually doing it, you'll find that 12 minutes is a long time to answer one of those questions, actually. I mean, again, I timed myself doing it, and it took me, like, 20 minutes or something like that. So I think an hour should be safe, so for the real one, that is, not for this one. But maybe. You don't have to get 100%. Much. Feel free to shove it in the middle, by the way, if you're nervous about it. But I'm present fact knows if I can't tell who anybody is anyway.